It's very expensive.
Boker Tov. If you haven't figured it out yet, today is the last day of Hanukkah. In my house, the Hanukkiot were already put back into their respective places. It's like the people who changed their chametz, Pesach Kelev back to chametz on the fourth Shvishal Pesach. So they should be ready on Motzi Yom Tov. So I just got a very cute email that's it's a parody on an announcement from the chief rabbinate giving us the proper zmanim, a sof achilat zman sufkaniyot for Yerushalayim, Tel Aviv, and Be'er Sheva. And already announced it 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, already. Yeah. All right. The topic, the excommunication of the Hanukkah story, is a subject that was raised many years ago by the Sefer called Ta'ameu Minagim. It's an anthology of different Minagim. I remember my father, Shalom, had that Sefer in the house. We didn't have that many Sfarim, but somehow or another that was there. And that was an early 20th century anthology of all kinds of Minhagim. And there, the question already was raised, how come there is no tractate, Masechet, in Shas for Hanukkah? We have for, we have a Masechet for practically everything. Besides Shabbat and Eruvin, which is related to Shabbat. And then there's Pesachim, and there's Yoma. Yoma means Hayom, Yoma Kippurim. Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Masechet Sukkah, and there's Masechet Ta'aniyot, fast days, and Moed Katan, Chol HaMoed, and there's Masechet Beitzah, which is Yom Tov, was known actually as Masechet Yom Tov, because there are all kinds of halachot that apply to all the Chagim, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, and Rosh Hashanah. So it begins with Beitzah, Shenodah, B'Yom Tov, but the Rambam calls it Masechet Yom Tov. So all this is Chagiga, days of Beit HaMikdash. So all these are Seder Moed. There is nothing there as a Masechet, as an organized unit called Masechet Chanukah. And this raised some eyebrows. And there were various suggestions that were given as to what might be the reason. Some historical, or let's just say pseudo-historical, and some seem to have some basis. One cannot argue the point that there is no masechet, tractate, formal masechet. But does that mean that Hanukkah was excommunicated from the sources? Excommunicated means like putting in a cherem. We're not going to look at it, we're going to deal with it. And this is how the story is launched. Because in the book called Sefer Ta'amei HaMinhagim, he refers to a view that's unsubstantiated. Unsubstantiated means it's not written in any of the writings, nor any of the credible people who brought the tradition of the Chatam Sofer. Chatam Sofer lived in Pressburg in the 19th century. He actually, a lot of people don't know this, hails from Frankfurt, which means the two main individuals who fought reform and emancipation at the time, or how Judaism should deal with reform and emancipation, and had completely different viewpoints and takes on how to do it, Rosham Shofal Hirsch and the Chatam Sofer, they both had roots in Frankfurt, although Hirsch was not born in Frankfurt. He migrates to Frankfurt, but he's certainly associated with Frankfurt. And the Chatam Sofer was never associated with Frankfurt, he actually was born there. But he makes it to Transylvania, Pressburg, and that's where he's famous. And certainly things that came out of the Chatam Sofer are treated extremely seriously. But I say again, we have sources, we have many sources of the Chatam Sofer. He wrote extensively, both on commentary to Gemarot, specifically to the three pages in the Gemara, I stress, the Gemara, Maseret Shabbat, that deals with the laws of Hanukkah, and he does not raise this issue at all. He writes She'elot to Tshuvot. He writes about Chagim, which means he has chapters on Hanukkah. Some of all these known sources, we don't have a clue of what the Chatam Sofer is thinking, is why there is no Masechet Mishnah for Hanukkah. It could be he never thought of it. But nevertheless, it's been quoted in his name, and this is already second-hand, perhaps third-hand information in an anthology called Ta'amei Minagim, where the Chatam Sofer is referred to have said that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who came from the descendants of David HaMelech, the pasuk in Parshat Vayechi, which emphasizes that the kingdom, the monarchy, will stay and will remain in the hands of Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda, the Malchut Beit David, and here Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is the prince of the Sanhedrin. So while he's not a melech, but he's after Churban HaBayit, and this became somehow he was a functionary, a public functionary. Not only in the halachic sense, but he was the one who would be the emissary to go to Rome to intercede on behalf of Am Yisrael. So he had royal powers to a certain degree on an autonomous level with Am Yisrael. Being that that's the case, the Chashmonaim who came from Shevet Levi, they were Kohanim, and unfortunately, after the second generation of the Chashmonaim, things actually degenerated. You know, we say, and they were Rabbim Biad Matim and then the Rishayim Biad Tzadikim, so they were Tzadikim, and the Rambam says it clearly, they were Kohanim Gedolim. Gedolim doesn't mean that the Tafkid, the job Kohen Gedol, it means they were very, very great people, the Chashmonaim at the time of Hanukkah. But it degenerates, the subsequent generations are not exactly Kohanim Gedolim, and it became very, very cheap politics at the end of the day. And ultimately, it was lost. When it came to Horodes was questionable whether he was Jewish even. But he's really the last of what might be considered the dynasty of the Chashmonaim. So there was a real issue where Yanai HaMelech ran the Sanhedrin out of town. The Yehuda ben Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tamai, they went off to Egypt to flee. They fled to Egypt. So there was a rift, a real rift between the Sanhedrin and the monarchy. So the suggestion that's quoted in the name of the Chatam Sofer, that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi wanted to play down the Hanukkah story because he's still harboring this broges, this historic broges between the family of the Nasi'im and the Malchut, the kingdom, the monarchy, the dynasty of the Chashmonaim. That's a suggestion that was given. But just because it was a suggestion doesn't make it Torat Moshe. No less than the suggestion of Darwin's evolutionary theories. Right? Okay, suggestion. Very nice. And sometimes in science, in the absence of anything else, so the suggestion becomes fact. But it doesn't become fact just because it's a suggestion. Can't prove it. It's not science. It's speculative. That's all. So this is a speculation. The one who tried to make some order into this question was a Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria, Zichrono Livracha. Just 2 weeks ago, I mentioned his name in passing with regard to Yutet Kislev, where his Yortzeit was on 22 years ago, was on Yutet Kislev. He was the founder of the Shivut Bnei Akiva movement. He was the founder of the first Yeshiva Bnei Akiva in Kfar Oeh in 1940. And ultimately, this blossoms into a network of yeshivot and ulpanot, and some of the yeshivot has there. I don't get paid by Moslot Yeshivot Bnei Akiva, but I can tell you there are 75 institutions on the map that carry the badge of Yeshivot Bnei Akiva, which is remarkable. And he was one of the last of the Talmidim of Rav Kook, senior, not Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, but the Rav Kook senior, who died in 1935. You know, it's like the Mishnah says about Shimon HaTzadik, Mishyarei Knesset HaGdolah, the remnant, last one, one of the last ones. He was a young student at the time, in the days of Rav Kook. So, Rav Neria writes an article called Madua Lo Nishnu Halachot Chanukah B'Mishnah. Why were the laws of Hanukkah not written in the Mishnah? So he begins with this Tameh Menagim, and he rejects it out of hand. He feels it's even insulting to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. I mean, you think these are people, 21st century politicians, who carry a grudge, and that's why they're not going to talk about a mitzvah that Chazal made and established as a mitzvah. That's a far cry. But what Rav Neri does, he marshals some other sources which could possibly be reasons. And one of the reasons he brings is that it's been written already. Now, where was it written already? So we know there's a book called Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit is a document that was authored several years before the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. And it's basically a calendar. But it's not a full-blown calendar. It's a calendar of special events. Like you have sometimes in a shul calendar, special events. You don't have every day listed. You have only the dates of the special events. And all the special events are chagim. There are all kinds of chagim that you're not allowed to eulogize on these days, and you're not allowed to fast on these days. Which festivals are we talking about? So the Gemara tells us in Masechet Rosh Hashanah that after the destruction of Second Beit Mikdash, the halachic validity of the Megillat Ta'anit ended because they were no longer relevant, these chagim, except for two. Two festivals survive the destruction of Beit Mikdash. One is Purim, one is Hanukkah. Both are mentioned in Megillat Ta'anit. But Purim is already in Tanakh. It's part of Kitvei HaKodesh, Megillat Esther. So that enjoys more significance in terms of relevance, especially the Pasuk, V'zichram lo yasuf mizaram, Am Yisrael would never forget. And they sent out letters the subsequent year, so to remind them to keep the Purim, and so on. So Purim has a solid basis. Hanukkah is listed like any of the others on the 25th of Kislev for 8 days. Lo mitanan bahon v'lo lo lispeid bahon v'lo litanon bahon, not to eulogize, not to fast. Now, the whole Megillat Ta'anit is written in Aramaic of Eretz Yisrael. Just many of us may be familiar with Aramaic because we study Talmud Bavli. But the Aramaic of the Bavli, Babylonian Talmud, is a dialect of Aramaic. Aramaic was a Semitic language that was spoken in various countries in the Middle East. But the Aramaic of the Gemara is their Yiddish. Is their Yiddish. Now when we say today Yiddish, what do you mean? You mean basically a Germanic dialect. It's German with Hebrew letters, some Hebrew flavoring, some Hebrew words filtering in, and we call it Yiddish. But the impact of the local tongue is evident when you hear three Jews speaking Yiddish. One from Lithuania, one from Hungary, one from Poland, and maybe a fourth, one from Germany. And you can pick them out immediately just by listening to the Yiddish. And the fifth would be an American kid learning in some cheder in Brooklyn who speaks Yiddish on the street to his friends because that's the language that they speak at home. So when once upon a time in Yiddish, in pure Yiddish, you said, open up the window, you said, effen de fenster. Now in Brooklyn you hear, effen de winde. Effen de winde. Right, because the word, that's what happens. That's what happens to Yiddish. That's what happens to any language. And I remember I had a great professor, some of you may remember the name, Rabbi Professor Meir Hershkowitz, Zichrono Livracha, right, from Flatbush. And he was my great professor my first year at YU. He was a great teacher of Jewish history. Made us read the whole Antiquities of the Jews of Flavius Josephus and a few other books. You know, those days we didn't realize how important reading those books were. Later on, we first began to appreciate that it was very good that we had to read those books. But Rabbi Hershkowitz taught us that the idea of Yiddish goes back to Aramaic, where Jews adopted the local language and they converted it. They were Megayer. They made it into something Jewish. They took the local language, they used alphabet, not the alphabet of the Goyim, you know, and they used some Hebrew forms and some Hebrew flavoring, Jewish flavoring, and became a Yiddish of sorts. After Aramaic, you have Judeo-Arabic, which it's the same phenomenon. The base is literary Arabic, which, by the way, is different than spoken Arabic on the street. It's not al-Akhram. It's a literary Arabic. And it uses Aleph Bet. And it has also some Hebrew words floating in. The same phenomenon as we know for Yiddish. The Rambam wrote in Judeo-Arabic. Rav Sadia Gaon wrote. Rav Yehuda Levi wrote in Judeo-Arabic. That was the Yiddish. Then we have Ladino, which is the Spanish Yiddish. And then we have Rashi's La'az, which is Rashi's French Yiddish. People think, what's Belaz? Rashi gives a French word, it says Belaz, so we translate it Belashon Amzar. Okay, Belashon Amzar means a foreign language. But La'az means a foreign dialect, it's a word, Lamed Ayin Zayin, La'az. It means in a foreign language. What's the foreign language to Rashi? French. But he's writing it in alphabet. So he's writing, giving us a little bit of an insight into his Yiddish. And then from the 15th century on, Yiddish became German. And with German, I say again, in the various expressions of it. So Babylonian Aramaic is one thing, and the Yerushalmi, the Eretz Yisrael Gemara, Aramaic, is similar, but not identical. So when you are familiar with a certain Agadot in the Gemara and the language of Babylonian Aramaic, and then you read a text like Brich Shemei, which is in Eretz Yisrael Aramaic, it's not the same, it's not exactly the same as the Babylonian. It's not exactly the same. So the Megillat Ta'anit was written in Eretz Yisrael Aramaic, and all it was the date and the event, and that there's a prohibition of fasting and saying eulogies. There then are add-ons to the Megillat Ta'anit, two important add-ons. One is a section of fast days, because the original Megillat Ta'anit is really anti-fasting. It's the scroll of days that we don't fast. So why it's called Megillat Ta'anit is a good question. But later on, in the days of the Gemara, a few other dates were added on, and they are Chagim. They're Chagim. They're fast days. They're Mamish fast days. Mamish fast days. One of them is the fast day of the 8th of Tevet. So if you want to hear about it, you can hear my share this Sunday in London. I'll be happy to have you for a breakfast here in Edgware, and you'll hear all about it. Maybe I'll do it next Wednesday also. Because this relates to Asarav Tevet. Because actually it relates to the 10th, the 9th of Tevet also, which Wednesday is the 9th of Tevet. The fast of the 9th of Tevet. I'm sure you all fast the 9th of Tevet. Fast of the 9th of Tevet, it says the Shulchan Aruch, lo no da eza tzara erubo. We don't have a clue what happened on that day. That is fascinating. Because that automatically means censorship. Something was there, because the Jewish people don't forget anything. So we'll talk about it next week. So these fast days are somehow added to the Megillat Ta'anit. And the second, more important, is that there is a type of addition to the core book Megillat Ta'anit, known by the scholars as the Skolion, and it really is Breitot, material from the days of the Gemara, that were added on, not from the days of Gemara, the days of the Mishnah even, that were added on to, tacked on to the date. But this language is Hebrew, as you'd expect in a Mishnah or a Baita. But it's Hebrew. And you know, when a person speaks, normally you speak a particular language and you speak the language with the vocabulary of that language, and you don't jump from one language to the other, unless you're an Olech Hadash from America and you're a kid, you speak Hebrewish. Fine. Okay, so there are exceptions. But if you're a professional speaker, so you keep to the language. If you want to use a foreign word, you will translate it. You'll say it, and you'll say it in translation. That's acceptable. In a text as well. If you have a text, so you don't write in one language, in the middle of a sentence, you go over to another language. And this happens sometimes in the Gemara. And that's like sign number one, it's dual authorship. Somebody else wrote the other part, and some editor, you know, put a scotch tape and put the two pieces together, grafted the two sources together. So this is what you have with regard to Hanukkah. It says, it says, Be'esrin v'chamesh, Esrin, with a nun sofit, v'chamesh, which is the 25th, Be'tamnaya be', Tamnaya yomin, Eilin, Eilon. Tamnaya means eight. Tam Shmona, in Aramaic, the shin goes over to a taf, and so Tamnaya is Shmona. And that's that word launched the Hebrew word for a octopus, a tamnun, and an octagon, mituman. So this is all from the Aramaic. It hails from the Aramaic translation of Shmona, of eight. So Tamnaya be, dela lemispad bahon velo letanot bahon. No fasting, no eulogies, no fasting. And then all of a sudden, goes to the Hebrew. כשנכנסו יוונים להיכל, תימו כל השמונים שבהיכל, וכשגברה מלכות בית חשמונה יווניו, the whole story of the פח השמן. That wasn't part of the Megillah Ta'anit at all. That's an add-on. So Rav Neria says that much of the material that we know today as Dinei Chanukah, the laws of Chanukah, were found in the Megillah Ta'anit anyway. Now, what Rav Neria does not do, and I'm not even sure that he was aware of what I just said a moment ago, dual authorship. He just says that if you open up the Megillah Ta'anit, you get a lot of material about Chanukah that was like somehow tacked onto the date. Because the truth is, if you, we today have manuscripts of Megillah Ta'anit, and you see that all it is a calendar of special events. A date, an event. That's all, but without elaboration. But if you get a modern edition of a Megillah Ta'anit, you're going to see it's a book. Because after each date, there's a lot of writing. And what's that writing all about? This is material that was added on. And with regard to Chanukah, so a lot of halachic material was added on as well. So Rav Neria said that Rav Yehuda HaNasi was aware of this. That's a conjecture, because you don't know when the add-on took place. So to suggest that the Megillah Ta'anit was joined with other material prior to the year of Rav Yehuda HaNasi is a guess. But Rav Neria says that's possible. I agree, it's possible. But he says that if that's the case, then Rav Yehuda HaNasi didn't have to bother with an independent masechet, because we had the material anyway, and the Megillah Ta'anit was used. And being that Megillah Ta'anit would still be valid for Chanukah and Purim, so it wasn't a sefer that was, you know, stashed in the Geniza, but it was still on the halachic table for reading and for study and so on. So that's another reason. Again, it's a whole thing's a conjecture, but he feels a little bit more comfortable with that kind of rationale than saying that Rav Yehuda HaNasi was harboring a broigus in the name of the family for a few generations. And then Rav Neri goes on and he gives several others. At the very, very end of the article, it's almost incidental, he quotes somebody, he says, hey, somebody thinks such and such. Way before I saw this article from Rav Neria, which I only came across it several years ago, I had a different idea, and I was able to fortify my idea, and it's basically what Rav Neria brings at the very end as an incidental at the end. You know, somebody else said something, maybe he's right. But I think not only maybe he's right, but I think he's right. And so I'm going to make my case. Indeed, Rav Yehuda HaNasi organized the Mishnah. So what is the Mishnah? What is the Mishnah? The Mishnah is a compilation of the oral law up until the days of Rav Yehuda HaNasi. Why do we have it in writing? We have it in writing because the Sanhedrin is floundering. The Sanhedrin becomes political appointees. The Sanhedrin, if you had a rich mother-in-law, you can buy yourself a seat. If you had powerful people in the family who could pull the strings, you could get elected. It's very sad. Sound familiar? So eventually, the Sanhedrin falls apart. It falls apart because, bad enough, bad enough that reputable people were being put on the Sanhedrin by non-reputable means. Eventually, non-reputable people were put on the Sanhedrin, like the Karaim. Not that they're not Karaim, they're Tzedukim. Who are the Tzedukim? The Sadducees said. They didn't believe in the oral law. What is the principal job of the Sanhedrin? It's not to educate, but it's to be the guardians of the oral law. There are here and there scenarios where the Mishnah says you have to have a Sanhedrin. If you have a regular case of murder, you need 23 dayanim. But if the Kohen Gadol is a murderer, you need 71. How many times was the Kohen Gadol a murderer? That says you need 71 to establish Ir HaNidachat. That's a city that everybody in the city was convinced to serve idolatry. The Tosefta says it never happened. It's like Ben Soreh Moreh. Never happened. And there's 1871 to authorize the king to go out to an optional war, Mechervet Rishud. It happened, but didn't happen every Monday and Thursday. The Rav once pointed out that if the Sanhedrin would exist only for those scenarios that you required a Sanhedrin, 71 Dayanim, to adjudicate, they'd be retired. They'd be on vacation most of the time. But the job of the Sanhedrin was to be the kolel of 70 Skenim sitting and studying Torah. You had a shaila, that's the address. And if they didn't have an answer, they would sit and discuss it and vote on it. And whatever they said, after a vote of 36 to 35, acharei rabim latot, majority rules, that's the halacha for everybody. There's no such thing as dissenting opinion. You dissent, you're in violation of lo tasum in a davar asher yagid l'chayim min ismol. And if you happen to be a dayan and dissent at the end of the day, after the vote, it's capital punishment offense. It's zakei mamre. The authority was final. But how could that work if members of the Sanhedrin don't believe in the oral law? It's almost as silly as who votes for chief rabbi? You have 150 people who vote for chief rabbi of Israel. 150 people. 75 come from the rabbinic world. They are some dayanim, city rabbis of the big cities, some other rabbanim, who are also handpicked. But all right, 75. But the other 75 are all politicians. And it's based on the political representation of the Knesset. Now, once upon a time, it was an unwritten custom that even a non-religious party, they always have some, you know, people with kippot who are party activists. So the representative dati, religious fellow of the party, he'll be the one voting on behalf of the party. But that ended. Meretz ended it, and so on. You have people who are Mechal Shabbos, people who don't believe in God. They're voting for chief rabbi. And you think about it. But that's the case. So if you have people who are Sadducean sect, who don't believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh, and they're members of this council, this supreme council of guarding the Torah Shebaal Peh, it's an absurd situation. And eventually, nobody took it seriously. Like you asked the chief rabbinate, ask, you know, say the tefillah for Geshem. So I've heard more often enough. So who's the chief rabbinate already? I mean, that's what happened. That's what happened to the Sanhedrin. It fell apart. It fell apart, and we daven three times a day for its restoration. Ashiv Shavtenu Kvar Shana. So that's why Rabbi Yehuda Nasi had no choice but to commit to writing the last generation's opinions of the Sanhedrin. So he writes down things that if he wouldn't write it down, there would be a fear that things might get lost. He writes down different opinions as well, because his Sanhedrin, they really cannot close the door on any given issue. They don't want to close the door any longer. They feel they don't have the authority to close the door. So that's why the Mishnah has divergent opinions. And what we have today is nothing but consensus. There are all kinds of rules that are called consensus. Halacha ke Rabbi Akiva mechaviro. Rabbi Akiva against someone else, we pass it like Rabbi Akiva. That's an accepted consensus. But it's not ironclad, because there are exceptions. There are even exceptions to the rule, Yachid v'rabim halacha ke Rabbim. Chachamim against somebody. And all of a sudden, you see the Rambam holds like the somebody against Chachamim. Of course, it has to be understood why. But the fact is that the rules are nothing more than a generally accepted consensus, but subject to change. So this is what the Mishnah is all about. If you look at source number one, the Rambam in his Mishnah commentary says something very, very interesting about the Mishnah itself. Vida, and you shall know. She'ena Mishnah midaberet, the Mishnah does not deal with the isur davar she'isuro barur, with prohibitions that the prohibition is clear to all. O beheter davar, beheter davar sheheteru barur, or with matters of permissibility where the permissibility is known and clear to all. Ela, but aval, oseket beisur ma she'efshar sheyale al hadat shehu mutar. The Mishnah deals with prohibitions that you actually might think are permissible, or beheter with a permissibility, ma sheyale al hadat shehu asur. You might actually think it's prohibited. Aval inyanim habrurim, those matters that are clear, lo dibra bahem. Which means the Rambam is already telling us the Mishnah is not a closed book on Torah Shebal Peh. It's not all-inclusive. And this is one of the major, major innovations of the Rambam himself in his Mishnah Torah, which was basically an updated version of Mishnayot, but taking 1,000 years of learning into consideration since Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, all of the Talmud, Bavli and Shalmi, all of the Geonim, bringing it to the 12th century. But the Rambam says, what I have in my book, nothing is left out. That was never done before nor after. There's never a book in halachic literature that undertook such a bold enterprise as having it all-inclusive. Occasionally, some of the very, very sharp eyes in the last 800 years will discover what's called Hashmatot HaRambam. Rambam left something out. And the something out that the Rambam leaves out is cause for concern. Because the Rambam didn't forget anything. And if something was obvious in the Gemara and he left it out, there's got to be a good reason for it. And it has to make sense in light of everything else that's in the book. Apparently the Rambam understood that line in the Gemara as reflecting a viewpoint that's non-halachic. And that's a study in itself. I have a friend that was going to do a doctorate at Bar Ilan on the very, very subject of Hashmatot HaRambam, on the Rambam deletions. So I said, good luck, I'm trying to figure out what the Rambam wrote, and you're going to tell me what the Rambam didn't write. But there's a lot more that he wrote than what he didn't write. But the first thing you have to do is figure out what he left out. And you have to go through all the 800 years worth of writings to see who, you know, came up with the idea, ooh, the Rambam left this out. You know? So here the Rambam says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was not all-inclusive at all. V'tzarich lish'ol she'la zu tamid. Klomar, lomar mai kamashmalan. What did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi come to add? What did he come to clarify? Imaya davar nireh barur. If everything looks so perfectly clear in the Mishnah, and the law that's being talked about is known, why did the Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi bring it into the Mishnah? Every time you come across such an example, it begs to ask that question. Because if it was so clear, then the Rambam actually wouldn't have bothered, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would not have bothered entering it into the Mishnah. So there are over 100 cases in the Rambam's Mishnah commentary. Sorry, I didn't bring the pages, but you're going to have to trust me on this, because I have this at home, every source. Over 100 sources in the Rambam's Mishnah commentary where he says a phrase, Kol ze barur ve'eino tzarich pirush. This is clear, and I don't have to explain it. Or simply, Kol ze barur. This is clear. Now, why is the Rambam wasting ink on a phrase like that? Because the Rambam thinks that you might erroneously, with your crooked head, think that the Mishnah is suggesting something else. So the Rambam is saying, put your head straight on and read it, and that's what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi meant. In other words, even in those cases, the Rambam indicates that you could slip off the track. You could derail here if you start thinking too hard. Don't think too hard. It's exactly what you saw in the first place as superficially read. That's what it is. Kol ze barur ve'no tzarich pirush. I mean, even such an idea, the Rambam felt there was a need to make such an indication. Now, this plays itself out in source number 2 with regard to tefillin and tzitzis. Tefillin and tzitzis are mentioned in the 4th chapter of Masechet Menachot. And there are just a handful of halachot that are discussed in that perek. One is the famous one. If you only have the white and not the blue, or just the blue and not the white, do you still have a mitzvah? So even if you've never opened up Masechet Menachot in your life, you know the answer is yes, you do have a mitzvah, because for hundreds and hundreds of years we didn't have the tchelet, and yet the people are wearing white tzitzit and making a bracha. So obviously we think you do have a mitzvah. So the Mishnah that says atchelet eino ma'akevet et alavan v'alavan eino ma'akevet et atchelet, the white doesn't take away from the blue and the blue doesn't take away from the white, is an important Mishnah that should appear in the Mishnayot. But you know how many halachot there are for tzitzis and tefillin? You open up Shulchan Aruch, you see so many different halachot, and none of it is in the Mishnah. So the Rambam has to give us a reason. So if you look at source number two, V'omru, and it says in the Mishnah, V'alavan eino ma'kevet atcheilet, hushe'im asa tzitzit b'shlemut lavan, if you, all the tzitzis are white, utcheilet, v'nitgardem halavan, v'lo nishtayer mimena mishulshal, should be mishulash, mishal kulam, v'nishtayer atcheilet levado, harei ze yatzai derobato. The Rambam is saying is that you can have a scenario where tzitzis were made properly with blue and white, but somehow or another, one of the colors, the blue, let's say, faded. It really shouldn't fade, but it was ripped. So I don't want to get into how many strings you have to have originally in order for still to have just white without the blue. That's a machloket in itself. But he gives an example. Da shatchelet v'alavan avo pisha einman makvim zuazu, even though they don't detract from one another, hare gahem yachat mitzvah achat v'lo shtei mitzvot. Don't think for a second there's a mitzvah to wear white tzitzis and a mitzvah to wear blue tzitzis. It's one mitzvah. It just so happens that if you don't have one or the other, you still have a mitzvah. But it's not that it's two different mitzvot. Aval tefillah shel yad v'tefillah shel rosh, the tefillin of the yad, of the hand, tefillin of the rosh, hem shtei mitzvot. They're two different mitzvot in the scheme of 613. And a person doesn't have an arm, or even if the arm, the elbow, but a muscle is covered, let's say, and with a cast, and he can't put his tefillin on the arm, so you never put it on the other arm, by the way, never. Whatever hand you put on from days of bar mitzvah, that becomes your arm. So if you can't put on tefillin shel yad, or a person has an amputation, so he still has the mitzvah tefillin shel rosh, still has to put on there. And if you don't have a head, you still have the mitzvah of tefillin shel yad. And I always tell people, I know more people without a head than without an arm. So
you don't
this
put an arm, you don't put it on the other arm.
No, absolutely not.
And you do put it on a cast?
No, because it's a chatzitza. But only if the cast is on the muscle area. If the cast is on the arm area, but beyond the elbow, then you can put it on. The winding of the tefillin can be on the cast. That's not a problem. The tefillin itself has to be on the muscle. Right. All right, so next time you put on tefillin, you should
know. My grandson.
Okay, Pseda.
It's nice to know.
Yeah, of course it's nice to know. For sure. So the Rambam counts tzitzis as one mitzvah in the scheme of 613, and tefillin as two mitzvot. K'mo she'birarnu et zeh b'sifreinu b'minyan ha-mitzvot. Which book is he referring to? Sefer HaMitzvot. One second. When did the Rambam write Sefer HaMitzvot? Before the Mishnah commentary, or after?
After.
So how is the Rambam quoting himself in an earlier book? So of course somebody's going to say he was a Navi, right?
He went back,
obviously. The Rambam never shut the door, slammed shut on his Mishnah commentary, but the book was wide open to the end of his life, and he's adding material constantly. So you have now an add-on in the Mishnah commentary. Lefikach, therefore, kol zman sheiniach echad mehem, klomar, shelavshu, harei ze ki mitzvah taseh achat, v'yatzai dechovato. As long as you have one of them on, you have a mitzvah. Aval dinei atzitzit v'tfilin v'amzuzot, v'seder asiyatan, the way they're made, and the brachot haruyot lehem, the proper brachot, v'chol adinim ha-shayachim lekach, ha-shvashelot shenadoru behen, and all the various complications, shaylot, and so on, ein matarat Chiburenu l'daber b'kach. Rambam says, I'm not going to start elaborating on that. Lefi she'anachnu mifarshim. I'm a commentator here. I'm not writing a book of code of law. In the Mishnah Torah, which is codes, there, the Rambam has a whole section called Hilchot Tefillin, and a whole section called Hilchot Tzitzit. But here in the Perush HaMishnah, I'm giving a commentary on something somebody else put together. So I'm linked to his text. Hare HaMishnah lo kava lemitzvot elu dvarim yuchadim hakolelim et kol mishpateyem kavod kedeshim nefarsham. The Mishnah doesn't include all of the details of tzitzis and tefillin that I should come along now and comment on it. So I'm not just going to throw in my own two cents here. B'tam hadavar. So why doesn't the Mishnah have it? Lidati, according to my opinion, pirsumo bizman chibur haMishnah. These mitzvahs were so well known and so popular and so accepted, even the details of the mitzvah, there was no need for Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi to put it into the Mishnah. Unlike today, not everybody knows how to tie tzitzis. Not everybody knows how to write a prayer tefillin or tie the straps of tefillin. But in those days, it was common practice for people to do it on their own. Just like, not such a long time ago, many people knew how to shech the chicken. Right? You know, today, who knows how to shech the... Who knows how to do melicha? So some of you still remember how to do melicha. Today, they take the Beis Yaakov girls when they're bat mitzvah and they teach them melicha. But that's the first and the last time they ever see melicha. Because salting the meat. Because who salts meat? Anybody still salt meat?
I used to.
Okay. You outgrew it. Okay.
My dad was a butcher.
There you go.
Sometimes he had it was he did the bagisi.
Yafe.
And he said, do you want to kasher it or do you want me to do it?
The only thing that I remember my mother ever did was sometimes livers, broil the livers on the open fire, right.
And I did that in the back of the book.
Okay. Yafe. But the Rambam believed that the tzitzis and tefillin, that tzitzis and tefillin was so popular in the sense that the details of the halachot was so known that there was no reason to include it in the Mishnah. And if it's not in the Mishnah, says the Rambam, I don't have to comment on it because it's not there. It's not there. So this is a very, very important statement. Very important. And he goes on to give some other examples. He says, for example, the Nusach of Davening. You have two chapters in Masechet Brachot about the laws of davening. But there's a lot about the laws of davening that are not in the Mishnah. And the Rambam says, because they were known to everybody who davens. You know, the Mishnah doesn't have to tell us ABCs of davening. The Mishnah carries on where the thinking is that these are details already that most people, or many, or certain people wouldn't know. Certain people would know we have to put it in the Mishnah. That Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi didn't write it for the 21st century. He wrote it for his generation. And he assumed certain things. The Rambam wrote it for every generation. The Rambam doesn't assume anything. He doesn't assume that anybody knows anything. And he's writing for all of Klal Yisrael. Not just for the Rav's grandfather in Brisk. He's writing it for everybody. So this is very important. Why is it important? Because one can easily enough suggest that Hanukkah candles were so popular and so known and so well practiced that there was no need to write it in the Mishnah. You don't have to do that. And I'll even give you a good example, a good explanation to add on to this. Here in Medinat Yisrael, so Baruch Hashem, Jewish country, and there are many, many Jewish symbols even that go beyond being religious symbols. So many of our chagim have become national symbols. I think the most national is Hanukkah. Why did the general Zionist enterprise embrace Hanukkah? Because this is what they were looking for. Rabim biyad ma'atim, giborim. You know, they weren't so focused, let's say, on the Beit HaMikdash. But when it comes to the restoration of Jewish sovereignty and so on, military victory, you know, this was big news for the Zionist enterprise, and they embraced it. So Hanukkah is a very, very nationalistic Yom Tov affair and expresses itself in the media and so on. And in all likelihood, this was the case in the days of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi also, because it reminded people that, you know, okay, so we were under the Greeks, but then we were able to shirk the burden of the yoke of the Greeks. And even though now they're under the Romans, so it gives them chizuk, gives them strength. We'll take care of the Romans also one day. And that's what's important. Everybody knew Hanukkah. It was an issue. So to say excommunicated, and there are even further to augment this, what I'm saying. This wasn't excommunicated. Excommunication means not there. Not there. What do you mean not there? We're going to see now at least 8 references in the Mishnah to Hanukkah. But not in an organized form. Not here's how you light candles. But Hanukkah as a Yom Tov in the calendar within the framework of Moadei Yisrael, other Chagim, for various halachot, like Kriyat HaTorah. So let's take a look at source number 3. Source number 3 is from Bikurim. Bikurim is many times associated with Shavuot. But it's not a Shavuos mitzvah. It's a seasonal mitzvah. From Shavuot until. You have to take the new fruits, after the harvest the new fruits, until a certain date, bring them up in a basket to Yerushalayim, Beit HaMikdash, say a few psukim from Parshat Ki Tavoh, and you've done the mitzvah. So, the Mishnah says, Me'atzeret, Atzeret is a nickname of Chag HaShavuot, Ve'ad Hechag, Hechag means Sukkot, Me'vi V'koreh, you bring the Bikurim and you read the psukim. But Minachag, Ve'ad Chanukah, from Sukkot until Hanukkah, Me'vi Ve'ino Koreh, you bring the Bikurim, but you don't read the psukim. The question is, why not? Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira Omer argues and says, Me'vi V'koreh, until Hanukkah you can bring and read the psukim. What's the problem with the psukim? So just as an understanding, the Mishnah says that there are several people that bring Bikurim, and for whatever reasons, they are exempt from reading the psukim. There's a whole discussion about a convert, a machloket, with regard to dispute. But the convert reads the psukim. Because the psukim remind us about our promised Abraham Avinu of Eretz Yisrael and the division of the land. The ger was not part of that. So how is he able to say this? It would be not non-factual for him. So there's an opinion that says, ger mevive no kore. Rambam challenges this based on an opinion in a braita in the Yerushalmi. Against the Mishnah. It says, a ger, his spiritual father was Avram Avinu. You ever hear how a ger is called up to the Torah?
Yeah.
Whatever his name, they give him, Meir, Ben Avraham. He's always Ben Avraham. She's Bat Sara.
No.
That's what a ger is. So even though there are a few missing links of maybe 2,000-3,000 years, but he's a son of Avram Avinu. Mm-hmm. And Avram Avinu received the Avtacha. Avram Avinu was Av Amon Goyim, was the international spiritual father, and if he's part of that, so he's part of everything that went on, if the Avraham Avinu retroactively. That's how Rambam understood it. And he can say, Elokeinu, Elokei Avoteinu, he can say, Shasani Sim La Avoteinu, Bayim Mehem Azman Hazeh. There was a machloket on this, but the Rambam takes a strong stand in favor that Ger should be able to read the parasha of the Bikurim, even though there are many poskim that say otherwise. With regard to the season, you have here in the Mishnah, from Sukkot until Hanukkah, maybe Ve'no Koreh. Why? Why might it be Ve'no Koreh? Because the season of Chag HaKatzir, celebrating the Asif rather, Chag HaAsif is Sukkot, which means it's over, the agricultural year has come to an end. So if you're bringing Bikurim from Sukkot to Hanukkah, it's late. It's not part of the season of the harvest from Shavuot, Chag HaKatzir, until Chag HaAsif, which is Sukkot. What is the rationale of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira? One of the 7 fruits, the harvesting goes beyond Sukkot. The Zayit, the olive. And you can imagine already its connection to Hanukkah. Because the principal reason for growth of olives was not to eat an olive as part of your salad, but it was to squeeze it and to make it into olive oil. Olive oil was a very, very important produce of Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, Hanukkah becomes the end game. After Hanukkah, forget about Bikurim. You know, as they say, Litvot, we'll see you next year. But you see the Hanukkah is mentioned as a target date in the calendar. Source number 4. The Mishnah in the 7th Rosh Hashanah tells us that in the days that we were still establishing Rosh Chodesh based on the visual sighting of the moon. So I know for many students it's hard to believe that there was such a thing as without cell phones. without internet, without Twitter, and so on. There was a problem of communication, how to get the word out to Am Yisrael. So they sent messenger. First they started with a sequence of bonfires on mountaintops, but that got messed up. So they sent out messengers to various communities. But they didn't send it out for every month. They only sent it out for the months that there was some reason to know the exact date in the month. Al shisha chodeshim ashluchim yotzim. The messenger went out half a year, six different Rosh Chodesh dates. Al Nisan, for Rosh Chodesh Nisan, b'nei HaPesach, because they had to know when the 15th was. Al Av, b'nei HaTanit, they should know when Tisha B'Av is. Al Elul, which by the way, this led the Rambam to believe that in the days of Beit Sheni, they observed Tisha B'Av. He believed they didn't observe the other fast days, but even though the Beit Mikdash was standing and functioning and up and running, we still fasted on Tisha B'Av. That's a speech in itself. Why? Not everybody agreed with the Rambam. Al Elul, b'nei Rosh Hashanah. Well, if you know when Elul is, you're going to know when Rosh Hashanah is. Why? Because there was a tradition that Elul only had 29 days. There was never Elul for 30 days. So therefore, all you had to know was when Aleph Elul was, and you knew that 30 days later was the first of Tishrei, that's Rosh Hashanah. But they also sent out messengers for Tishrei, which means Rosh Chodesh Tishrei, which is Rosh Hashanah, Mibnei Takanat HaMoadot. There could be an unusual scenario where they didn't do Rosh Chodesh Tishrei the day after the 29th, and they did let it lapse into the 30th day. In theory, it could happen, and therefore there would be a need to at least get the word out when's Yom Kippur and when's Sukkot. So they sent out also for Tishrei. Al Kislev, Mibnei Chanukah. Well, you have to know when the 25th is. And the only way you can know when the 25th is when you know when the 1st is. Val Adar, Mibnei Purim. And they sent out for Adar because of Purim. Ukeshaya Beit Mikdash Kayam, when Beit Mikdash stood, Yotzim Afal Iyar, Mibnei Pesach Katan, which we call Pesach Sheni. You have to know when the 14th of Iyar was. So here, another example. Chanukah is mentioned, incidentally, as part of the 6 months during the year that there was some good reason to inform Klal Yisrael when Rosh Chodesh was. And one of them was Kislev, because of Chanukah. Source number five. Ein gozrim ta'anit ala tzibur b'Rosh Chodesh. This is a list of days that we don't fast. When don't we fast? Public fast days. We don't have public fast days on Rosh Chodesh. Public fast days for crisis, by the way. Even for crisis. We're talking about public fast days for crisis, of drought, of rain, and so on. You don't make a fast day on Rosh Chodesh, or on Chanukah, or on Purim. I mean, you know, Chanukah again has made a showing here as the, one of the days that we don't have public fast days. We jump to source number six. Rosh Chodesh Adar Shechaliot B'Shabbat. This is about a Kriyat HaTorah of the four Parshiot. But I'm not concerned now with the four Parshiot. The second to the last line in the middle. Lakol mafsikim b'roshei chodashim b'chanukah b'purim b'taniyot u'ma'amadot b'yom kippurim. Which means, when, if you have, let's say, Chanukah on a Monday or Thursday, like we had just the past Monday, so we defer, we don't have the regular Parshat Vayigash. Now, Monday and Thursday, we should have been reading Vayigash. Tomorrow is not Chanukah, so we'll read Vayigash on Thursday morning. But on special days, we defer. We take the regular Kriyat HaTorah and move it over for the special. So Rosh Chodesh, that falls out on a Monday or Thursday, we don't read the Parshat HaShavua reading. We read Rosh Chodesh. Chanukah, Purim, fast days. If you have Asarah B'Tevet, next week Asarah B'Tevet is on Thursday. So we won't be reading Parshat Vayechi in the morning. We're going to read Vayechal Moshe, the Kriyat HaTorah for Taniyot. So again, Chanukah is mentioned as part of a list of special days with regard to Kriyat HaTorah. And then in the next line, Mishnah Vav, it tells us what we read on any of the special days. B'Chanukah, we read Parshat HaNasi'im, which is exactly what we're doing these days. And this morning, we got a mouthful because there happened to be 12 Nasi'im, but only 8 days of Chanukah. So on day one, we read 1, day 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7, 7. Today we read 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and we went into Parshat Baalotcha. It's an interesting Ramban that says there's a reference, he says, a rem is the Chanukah. So we took it into already the Psukim that have to do with Zem Asem Nora and so on. Chanukah Nesiyim, Purim Vayavo Amalek, Rosh Chodashim, we read Rosh Chodashim from Parshat Pinchas. So the Mishnah tells us what we read on special occasions. So in this Mishnah, of what we read on special occasions, Chanukah has an appearance, and there's no attempt to excommunicate it at all. Next page, second side. In Masechet Moed Katan, this is about Chol HaMoed, but in the third chapter of Masechet Moed Katan, we learn all of the laws of mourning, Avelut, because it says, Ein Megalchin B'Moed, there are all kinds of halachot that refer to how do we deal with Avelut on Yom Tov, or on Chol HaMoed. So once the subject came up, how do you deal with Avelut on Yom Tov or Chol HaMoed? So the Mishnah already tacked on the various halachot of Avelut in the third chapter of Moed Katan. So in the days of old, they used to have Nashim Mekonenot, professional women criers. Right? If you remember the Haftarah for Tisha B'Av in the morning from Yirmiyahu Perekhet, because he calls out for them Mekonenot, the Tisa Alav Nehi, you know, let them cry. And the reason why they did that, because sometimes people are stoic and they feel they cannot let out their emotions. They feel it's not respectful, whatever. But you know, crying is contagious. And we know this from funerals. Sometimes you yourself may not have cried, but three people around you are crying and it brings it out. And by the way, laughter, the same thing. That's why in many, many comedian shows, they have people sitting in the audience who start laughing ridiculously, and that triggers laughter by others. See, you never do that, eh? I'm a good comedian.
You have the sign that goes laugh.
Right, they have the sign that goes laugh. Right. That's right. I'm not going to reveal who's my laughter here, but same thing with crying. Same thing. So you have the Nashim Mekonenot. But there's certain days, let's say on Chol HaMoed you can have a Levaya, but the Chazal wanted to tone down the crying, even though the Avelim are in deep hurt. So therefore, no Mekonenot. Let's not bring out the women who are professional criers. So this is what it means, B'Rosh Chodashim, on Rosh Chodesh, on Chanukah, and Purim, Me'anot u'mitapchot. Which means they bang a little bit, they make some noise. You know, it's a symbolic making a krechsing, you know, gasping. That's okay. But the mekonenot, the real McCoy crying, to hold off with. In source number 8 is the only example in all of the Mishnah where there's a direct reference to the mitzvah of lighting Chanukah candles. But it's also a backdoor entrance. So let's give it to you first orally, and then we'll read it inside. People who were at the marketplace, and sun is going down, the Shkia, so there were people who would light Chanukah candles at the marketplace, which is a nice thing to do. Well, before Chanukah, throughout the year, people would illuminate. They didn't have electric fluorescent lights, you know, in their booths. So they would make a little bit of a bonfire, like a torch of some sort. So what happens if a store owner, known as a chenvani, from the word chanut, store owner has a little fire to illuminate his stand, and some guy's coming with his donkey, and he's got the wares on it, like flax material. And the flax gets caught up in the flame, and everything goes up in flames. So who's responsible for damage? This is in the sixth chapter of Masechet Baba Kama, where the whole Masechet begins with the four major principles of damage: Arba Avot Izikin, Shor, Bor, Maver, and Hever. Hever means Eish, fire. Ki Teitze Eish U'Matzah Kotzim, Parshat Mishpatim. So the Mishnah gives us an interesting case of being responsible for fire damage. So here it says clearly that if the store owner has to be careful that where he puts the fire is not going to be on the roadway that's going to allow some person riding by with a camel with some wares on it to go up in flames. And if they do burn, the store owner is going to be held responsible. So that's what the Mishnah says with gamal or camel. Sheyata un pishtan, had flax on it. Vavar b'shut rabim, isn't the street. V'nichnas pishtano l'tocha chanut v'dalku b'nero shel chanvani, and the flax was sticking out. It was sticking out of the side of the camel, and it went up in flames from the candle, from the flame of the store owner who just had it on to illuminate the booth. V'dliket abira. Bala Gamal Chayav. It says here that the Bala Gamal is going to be, what happens if what happens, what goes on fire? Well, the fire is the guy's whole store goes on fire. So there's, who's really responsible here? It says Bala Gamal Chayav. But hiniach chenvani neiro mi bachutz. But if the first case is that the Gamal he went off the camel. Detoured from the public domain, and almost like got into the store. His flax entered into the store. A man can have a fire in his store, and here comes this gamal. He's not supposed to bring his camel there with his wares, and it everything went up in flames. The guy's booth went up in flames too. So the guy, the owner of the camel, is going to help be responsible. But what if the chenvani, the store owner, he put the fire outdoors? Then the store owner is going to be reliable if the flax of the owner of the camel goes up in flames. That's all year round. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bener Chanukah Patur. But if the guy and the camel flax went up in flames because the fellow in the store lit Chanukah candles outside his store where he was supposed to, so then the owner of the store is going to be exempt because he was in the line of duty. He was doing what he was supposed to do, and the owner of the camel should have remembered that it's Hanukkah. Keep your camel a safe distance away, because it can go up in flames. Now, it's interesting that this machloket between Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda, anonymous view in the Mishnah is usually Chachamim unless otherwise indicated. So the halakha is not in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda. The halakha is like Chachamim, that even in this case of Hanukkah, the store owner is going to be held liable. But the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi brings the view, the dissenting opinion, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bener Chanukah Patur, is an awareness that there is a mitzvah called Ner Chanukah in the Mishnah. Of course, what we have is in sources 9, 10, 11, which, 9, 10, which we're not going to do, are the sources in the Gemara. And the Gemara brings Breitot, that again, were most probably known, both about Nerot Chanukah, as well as Hallel, all this stuff is there. It's just Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, as an editor, did not bring it into the Mishnah. And most probably realized he didn't have that much material for a full-blown Masechet. How much do we have already in Masechet Shabbat? 3 pages. Masechet Shabbat is 120 pages. And you know where he sticks it in? In the second chapter that deals with Shabbos candles, Nerot Shabbat. And it's an interesting, very elegant way of how he does it, that he glosses into it because he deals with a particular issue that intersects with the laws of candles of Shabbat and candles of Chanukah. And once he's on the subject, then 3 pages of laws of Chanukah enter into the Gemara. But to say that Chanukah was excommunicated from the Mishnah, I think... I go back to what the Rambam says in source number 2. It must have been so well known and so popular, even the details, there was no need. But with regard to these specialized halachot, so what's Kriyat HaTorah? What about fasting on Chanukah? What about in the laws of Beit Din for Kiddush HaChodesh? All of these halachot, Availut and so on, all of these halachot, there's no need to have it mentioned in the Mishnah. And certainly, in Dinei Nezek and damages, the possibility that Ner Chanukah would cause an exemption of the store owner because of the mitzvah. So can you say Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who's the editor of the Mishnah, had a broigis with the mitzvah? For sure not. So I think Rav Neri is correct that we don't have a broigis here at all. That's inadmissible. And I think what he says at the very end of the article, where he quotes a sefer, he's actually a sefer I'm not familiar with, sefer HaEshel of Avraham Eliyahu. I never heard of this sefer, but it is very likely that it is correct that the Rambam simply felt Hanukkah was just such a popular thing. There was no need to write about it. There was no need for Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi to write about it. He, the Rambam, writes about it. He writes everything, including Hanukkah. Okay, next week we'll continue. And perhaps I will do something on the uniqueness of the 9th of Tevet. And we'll get back to our science and...
When does the practice of the lighting of the menorah actually take place?